welcome to By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Perrier, and as always, we're your guide to connecting the political, social, and economic movements shaping the world around us. And today we are going to be talking later in the show about debt collectors and some of the things happening around their rights, believe it or not. And also, of course, we're going to be talking quite a bit about the implications of the Trump-Putin meeting on the sidelines of the G20 meeting here today. But before we can move on, last night, a New Jersey Transit commuter train derailed while trying to enter Penn Station in New York City. The train carrying somewhere between 150 people appeared to only be damaged in a minor way, and thankfully no injuries were reported. The derailment also snarled up the Amtrak trains, the inner city trains, and resulted in significant travel issues for commuters of all types forced to find alternate routes. This comes about 3 months after another New Jersey Transit derailment created by a defective tracks, that is, that resulted in the closing down of 8 of 21 tracks, caused major delays for hundreds of thousands of travelers. And it comes just a few weeks before repairs start on Penn Station itself. Much needed repairs as the station is starting to fall apart. This, yet again, highlights the extraordinarily poor state of U.S. infrastructure. The American Society of Civil Engineers overall gives America a D-plus grade on infrastructure on their comprehensive quote-unquote report card that examines and rates the state of American infrastructure. When it comes to transit specifically, the ASCE grades the U.S. at a D-minus. That's surprising, but in 2015, 255 people were killed in transit-related accidents, so it makes sense why they'd have a low grade. The most recent estimate of the repair backlog in America's transit system is $90 billion, the number expected to grow to $122 billion by 2032. The funding picture for taking care of these issues isn't really that great either. First and foremost, given the way the country is structured, funding for transit infrastructure is a patchwork of federal, state, and local dollars in various places. Which makes the first problem that some areas are getting more attention than others. California, Illinois, Massachusetts, New York, and Pennsylvania provided 3/4 of all state funding for transit, while another 5 states, Alabama, Arizona, Hawaii, Nevada, and Utah, provided no funding for public transit. So even though in 2016, voters passed over $200 billion in funding for transit-related projects, some areas will get great stuff, some nothing, and many just stopgap funding to keep systems from totally collapsing. Now, the federal reauthorization of the FAST Act has provided $60 billion over 5 years for transit-related projects, but given the backlog and the varying degrees of attention to transit in various places, this, of course, won't meet all the needs. The other issue is that many of the funding projects are long-term, which often means that many of the problems in the systems get worse as time goes on because aging systems continue to age, even while some parts may be getting upgrades. So the scale of the problem is growing faster than efforts to fix it. Overall, this is true as well. The ASCE estimates that we have a 10-year, $2 trillion investment gap that needs to be bridged in the U.S. to deal more effectively with infrastructure, which, of course, is a serious matter when 1 in 9 bridges could collapse at any time. Obviously, this is nowhere near what is actually being allocated or even proposed. The most aggressive proposals in Congress are for $1 trillion in infrastructure spending. America's falling apart, literally bursting at the seams and unraveling, yet politicians seem to be doing very little to actually stop it. Betsy DeVos, the U.S. Secretary of Education, didn't have the greatest day yesterday. She and her department were hit with 2 separate lawsuits designed to stop her from delaying enforcement of a new rule to protect student loan borrowers known as the Borrower Defense Rule. The rule essentially is designed to make sure students at many of these fraudulent for-profit colleges can have their loans forgiven if a state takes action against one of these schools and shuts them down. And it also allows the federal government to try to get as much money as they can back from these companies, basically that created all their revenue off the federal student aid in the first place. The rule was set up after Corinthian Colleges and ITT Tech were forced to shut down after being found to have widely defrauded thousands of students and not doing what they said they were going to do in terms of jobs, but taking their money anyway. Specifically, the borrower defense rule, among other things, prevents schools like these from forcing students to sign agreements that they won't join class action lawsuits and that also force them into arbitration as opposed to court. The lawsuits came from two sources. First, a lawsuit by the Public Citizen Litigation Group on behalf of two Massachusetts students. The second from 19 state attorneys general. Both are alleging that it was not legal for Betsy DeVos to suspend enforcement of the rule, which was finalized in November and was supposed to take effect last week. The first lawsuit of the two students details that they were depending on the forced arbitration provision of the rule, and without it, they have the right to get their money back, but it's not really clear how, so they're stuck in a legal limbo, and that's why they sued. The states are basically arguing the same thing, just on a larger scale. DeVos is claiming they have to do it because of a lawsuit filed against the rule that they're going to start from scratch. In other words, they're going to water it down. For-profit colleges, people have been saying from the beginning, should see big gains under Trump. He obviously owns a for-profit college, had to go to court for defrauding people over that. DeVos also heavily supported same type of institutions and most expected that it would be pretty quick that the rollback of the various provisions of student loans that the Obama administration had put in there, it was going to happen quick. And obviously, it now is. If we need any more reminders of how important any of this really was, it's very relevant, as you could say. Wednesday, the Federal Trade Commission ruled that DeVry University had to pay $49 million to its students for running ads that deliberately deceived them about the job prospects that DeVry would make available once they graduated. Omar Khadr is a Canadian citizen and a former child inmate at Guantanamo Bay, will receive a settlement of $10.5 million Canadian. It's about $8 million U.S. and an apology from the Canadian government for breaching his constitutional rights under Canadian law by collaborating with the American interrogation of him at Guantanamo. Khadr's story, interesting story, one of the more well-known of the Guantanamo Bay cases out there. Khadr, who was living in Afghanistan right around the time of the 2001 invasion, U.S. invasion of Afghanistan. He was 15 years old. His father seemed to have been involved in something over there. And Khadr ended up in a camp that ended up being raided by U.S. Special Forces. Most of the people were killed there. But on a second sweep by U.S. Special Forces, they found Khadr. They claimed that he had thrown some sort of grenade at U.S. forces. They took him into custody. As Human Rights Watch notes, quote, U.S. and international law allows for detention of juveniles only as a last resort, require juveniles to be provided educational opportunities and housed separately from adults, and mandate a prompt determination of all cases involving children. Yet, as they go on to say, quote, Khadr was incarcerated with adults, reportedly subjected to abusive interrogations, and not provided with any educational opportunities. He was detained for more than 2 years before he was provided with access to an attorney, and for more than 3 years before he was charged. End quote. Khadr and his lawyers have also stated that he was tortured as well. It's a common practice at Guantanamo Bay and Bagram Air Force Base, where he was also held. Rolling Stone wrote an article on his torture. They write, quote, at Bagram, he was repeatedly brought into interrogation rooms on stretchers in great pain. Pain medication was withheld, apparently to induce cooperation. He was ordered to clean floors on his hands and knees while his wounds were still wet. When he could walk again, he was forced to stand for hours at a time with his hands tied above a doorframe. Interrogators put a bag over his head and held him still while attack dogs leapt at his chest. Sometimes he was kept chained in an interrogation room for so long he urinated on himself. End quote. Under all this pressure, Khadr ultimately pled guilty. However, he later recanted, took his case to the Canadian courts, where the Canadian Supreme Court ultimately ruled that they had violated his rights, the Canadians, by participating in this torture regime of America. He was released in 2015, able to seek damages, and now he got this settlement. This is actually the second such settlement for Canada. In 2007, they paid $10 million to someone they helped the U.S. rendition and torture. In 2008, Sweden had to pay $500,000 to someone they handed over to the Americans to torture in 2002. In 2010, the UK had to pay millions of pounds to 16 Guantanamo prisoners because of their role in the U.S. kidnapping and torture program. The only place, it seems, where no one has ever had to face even the tiniest bit of accountability for mass rendition, torture, and illegal detention of hundreds of people is the United States, the place that authored, created, and justified the program. Don't forget, it was President Obama who decided to let Bush's torturers off the hook. And those are today's talking points, and you are listening to By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Perrier, and as always, we're your guide to connecting the social, political, and economic movements shaping the world around us.
By Any Means Necessary.
And we are very happy to be joined here as we continue our conversation, shifting to the, I guess, very highly touted meeting here between President Donald Trump and Vladimir Putin on the sidelines of the G20 meeting. And again, we're happy to be joined here by Mark Sloboda, who's an international affairs and security analyst, and Peter Lavelle, who's a journalist and the host of RT's flagship show, Crosstalk. Thank both of you for joining the show.
Good to be here.
Eugene, thanks. An honor and a pleasure to be on by any means necessary.
The pleasure is all mine, and I wanted to start actually with a little of the pre-G20 activities of both leaders, which I thought were relatively indicative. Putin had the big meeting with President Xi of China, sent a pretty strong message there of Russian-Chinese cooperation. Trump goes to Poland, obviously sort of rabidly anti-Russian stance from the government there. He makes a big speech about threats from the quote-unquote South and the East. Seem to be pretty clear statements about the core direction both countries are pointing in. Now, Peter, I'll start with you here. Your thoughts on some of this lead up to the G20 meeting between Putin and Trump in the past couple of days?
Well, I think obviously for Putin, he wanted to show the G8 that a new G2, not the United States and China, but China and the United States, is creeping on the stage. I think this multipolar world is a reality, and it's just making itself better known. But I thought Trump's visit to Poland was absolutely brilliant. It was brilliant, and it was the best thing he could do. He had to show his critics back home that he's going to be tough on Russia, and now he can sit down with Putin now that this is all behind. The interesting thing for me is that the Polish visit placated his critics, I think some of them in the deep state, and not the media. I think what we've seen over the last few weeks with Trump's relationship with the media, particularly CNN, he doesn't care what they think. Okay, so I think he just went down a checklist to say, okay, I said this, I went to Poland, they're perfectly, I lived in Poland for many, many years, it's a very pro-American, the most pro-American country in Europe, one of the most pro-American countries in the world. So I think the optics of it all were very good, and then sitting down and talking, both of them were at the, in top form, and we've seen in the past when Putin would sit down with Obama, there was no chemistry. The first handshake, there was chemistry there. But will go anywhere, that remains to be seen.
Yes, no, certainly going to be very interesting to see how it plays out. Mark Sloboda, your thoughts on this issue?
Yeah, I think I mostly agree with Peter on Poland. I think there were two big reasons for Trump's trip to Poland. One is indeed tossing some bones to the democratic resistance, as they call themselves, and his neocon critics at home by some rhetorical playing up this pro-Polish, pro-Eastern Europe card. Then he enabled himself to sit down with Putin with a little bit more flexibility. There was even talk before the meeting that the basically a lot of his own deep state officials in his cabinet, McMasters and others, wanted Fiona Hill, who is now part of the administration and who is a notorious Putin, shall we say, critic. She's done the usual rounds. In order to become a critic, to become an expert on Russia and the U.S. nowadays, you have to write a Putin-bashing memoir. Well, she's done this. And they wanted her to sit in the room and hold his hand or his leash, whatever you want to call it, while the meeting was going on. And Trump, I guess, managed to avoid that embarrassment and those constraints. So that's a good plus. The other big significance, I think, of the Polish trip on this first occasion of this 3Cs initiative, particularly, is a slap across the face of Brussels and Berlin. Mm. This is a conservative American president meeting with the representatives of a conservative Polish government and many conservative leaders from across Eastern Europe in Warsaw, trying to form a power center that is opposed to, shall we say, the postmodern liberalism coming out of Brussels and Berlin. And Trump has walked right into that battle. I mean, he was, of course, drawn into it. during his election campaign, the leaders of Western Europe, Angela Merkel, leaders of France, the United Kingdom, all across the continent, basically endorsed Clinton, and many of their state medias, Germany included, were 24-hour Putin bashing. I mean, I'm sorry, Trump bashing, essentially. So, I mean, we don't call that meddling, of course, when their media does it. But that is Trump's attitude towards Europe. I mean, they endorsed his opponent, and now they have to pay the price of bad relations with Trump for the next 4 years. And it is obvious in the previous meetings, the NATO meetings we've seen with the leaders of Western Europe, Angela Merkel and Macron, et cetera, they were deliberately taking petty snubs against Trump the entire time, as well as the rhetoric that was directed against him. So by going to Poland and helping a Polish government, a conservative government, many call it, you want to call it right-leaning, I've seen sometimes in the New York Times, in their battles with Brussels. And Brussels is basically trying to sanction Poland for having a conservative government and for not accepting refugees, a domestic interference, which the EU has tried to force on all the countries of Eastern Europe, to which they have met with some pretty strong resistance. And they have popular support for that at home, it must be said.
Mm-hmm. No, that's a very interesting take there, I think, from both you guys about sort of the way this is playing. And I definitely want to come back to this issue of how sort of Europe is breaking in terms of, I think, both China and Russia and the moves that they're trying to play here. So I certainly want to bring that. You know, the interesting thing to me on some level, too, leading up to this is the way that the media sort of was portraying Putin so aggressively but it was just sort of, it was hard for me to even really fully understand what was going on, but just like the world's most sinister figure who is set up to roll Trump and you know, make it look bad and come out on the better side of it. I mean, all of this sort of like he must be the greatest politician and the most omnipotent person that there is. So I want to come back to that when we get back on this after the break here on By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. So I am your host, Eugene Perrier. Stay with us.
By any means necessary.
Welcome back to By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Perrier, and as always, we're your guide to connecting the political, social, and economic movements shaping the world around us. And we're continuing our conversation with Mark Sloboda and Peter Lavelle. And I wanted to come back to where I left off, Peter, because I was glad you brought up the issue of the media. And early this morning when I was just sort of looking at all of the sort of pre-coverage of the Trump-Putin meeting and how the different sort of outlets in the U.S. and the U.K. were trying to frame it, they all seemed to have one sort of major theme, which was Putin is excited about this meeting because he thinks that he can find some way to come out looking good based on the body language. I mean, all of this, like, I mean, it's like Putin must be the smartest person. He must be the most omnipotent person. It's just like this bizarre, sinister image that's just hard for me to really even fathom. Your thoughts?
Well, you know, number one, I looked at some of the media reactions, early in the morning in the United States, and, as usual, the liberal media, they just talk to themselves. It's a groupthink conversation, and it's just plain silly. But, you know, if you look at from the Russian side, my gut is that Vladimir Putin doesn't expect anything at all from this, okay? I mean, it's the first meeting. I would, you know, tell our listeners that, you know, for years now, you know, you have the political establishment in Russia primarily, there are exceptions, that are very distrustful of the United States and the West in general. They don't keep their word. You can't believe their promises. And I think that, you know, Putin is there and he's on a, hey, I'm just going to tear a page from Hillary Clinton. He's on a listening tour, okay? You know, all of this, you know, Russia's dividing Europe, you know, all this is all nonsense, as Mark pointed out very well. Is that Europe is tearing itself apart all by itself. And people like Macron and Merkel, they're the ones that are critical of the United States. No, that's not Russia's fault. Putin didn't do that. I mean, Russia, for the most part, is watching. And that's what it's been doing primarily, is watching what's going on. hey, when your phones are in a circular firing squad, don't get in the way. So this is the optics and the photographs and body language. I mean, this is just childish stuff. Okay, what about policy? And for example, Trump has put himself in a real pickle if he's going to vacate the polls. And then we have, energy security, and the Germans want their pipelines directly from Russia because Ukraine is an unreliable trading partner. I mean, now that just turns, turn it around. Okay, it's the Europeans who put themselves in this situation. Donald Trump will parachute in. Look, in Riyadh, I mean, he took all this credit for something he had nothing to do with, and he says, "What? I'm doing this for our allies." Now, the Russians are going to look at this very carefully with zero. I mean, absolutely zero expectations.
Mm-hmm. No, I think that's certainly true. I mean, it would make the most sense as well. And one other interesting issue, Mark, here, and this question was sparked when Peter mentioned Ukraine. That's one of the issues that's sort of on the table at the G20. Almost certainly, I assume, has had to have come up in the conversation between Putin and Trump. And that's an issue that in the U.S. has really, really, really flying under the radar. Although obviously, big things happening, the IMF restricting some of the funds because they feel Ukraine hasn't done enough to neoliberalize their economy and the like. But I'm curious, Mark, what are some of the things, if you could, I guess, perhaps surmise here, that if Putin and Trump are talking about Ukraine that they want to touch on? Because I think that's something that most people here are hearing, that they're going to talk about it, but not what, may even be said.
Okay. First, actually, I wanted to come back on what you, Peter, were talking about, the atmosphere going up to this meeting. The title of an actual article in the Daily Beast, "How Ex-Spies Think Putin Will Sucker Sociopathic Narcissist Trump," which includes the language supposedly from Naveed Jamali, a former undercover FBI double agent. "The Russians," Jamali added, "are devious, skilled at manipulating others into doing their bidding without recognizing it." And this echoes the former director of national intelligence, James Clapper, testifying to Congress under oath that the Russians are – the historical practices of the Russians, who are typically almost genetically driven to co-opt, penetrate, gain favor – which is a typical Russian technique. So I mean, anyone with Russian blood is genetically predisposed to lie, cheat, steal. This is coming from the voices of American officials. This is officially state-sanctioned racism. I mean, this goes beyond even the typical neo-McCarthyism and racism at this point. So this was the atmosphere going into this meeting. And I agree. I mean, prepare yourself for an absolute torrent of half-baked pop psychology, body language analysis of this meeting. It's really a joke. The new Kremlinology is commenting on and deciphering Trump's handshake.
Right.
That's Kremlinology.
Which I guess went well with Merkel, allegedly.
Yeah. But to Ukraine, all right, this is an issue that is not going away. I think that Trump is not in control of his own foreign policy to a large extent. Mattis and McMaster's are, and others. And I think he'll be given very little leeway to change anything. There has already been given enough signals from the leaders in Europe and from the United States, and certainly from the Ukraine for years now. There has been no progress on Minsk too. The Kiev regime, the Maidan regime that came to power overthrowing the democratically elected government in early 2014, they have no intention of fulfilling. They have not taken one single step towards political reconciliation with East Ukraine, meeting any of the conditions. I would say that, if Putin's intention was a political settlement, this cunning plan has failed. If the intention was merely a frozen conflict, another frozen conflict on Russia's borders, an intractable problem that they figured a frozen conflict was better than the alternative, a hot war, well, then it's been a success. But we're looking at a protracted frozen conflict going on for years. This problem is only entrenched. I don't see that Trump will be able to offer anything to remedy this, because whether the U.S. and Germany and France and others, they should have leverage over Poroshenko, the oligarch in charge of Ukraine, and his regime to push him to fulfill those conditions. But they certainly are not willing to use it. And I don't see Trump. Trump is no fan of the government in Kiev. They also openly endorsed Clinton. And there's actually far more evidence, as Politico has reported, of them interfering in the election in support of Clinton than anything of Russia's doing. He doesn't forget that. But I don't think he has the leeway to put any leverage on Kiev simply because of the U.S. Deep state and the foreign policy blob.
Well, you know, Peter, one thing that's interesting to me about this question. Well, go ahead, yeah.
Well, I was just going to say that I agree with Mark there, is that the U.S. doesn't have any solutions for Ukraine at all, okay? But it is something that they're going to hold over Trump. That's what they want to do. This is the leverage they have. But I think it's really interesting. What I want to find out, I know there'll be no movement on Ukraine, and in public, behind closed doors, none. I guarantee you that. But it's Syria. And I think that's what's going to be very interesting, because you know what? Because the U.S. Russia there. They need Russia's involvement in whatever machinations they have in mind, which I don't think is going to go anywhere. These no-fly zones, if that means the Syrian government can't fly over its own territory, it's a dead letter. It's dead on arrival. Okay, I'm sorry I interrupted. I'm a host too, so I tend to do that. Go ahead.
No. Well, it's all good. And as a former veteran of crosstalk, I'm all for that method of a discussion. But I think that's a great point on Syria, and it actually leads into my question, which, you know, it seems like to me, and I'm glad. So I was glad you brought up the point of the G2 earlier, that in some ways Trump is also playing catch up here. I mean, on Syria, certainly in the Korean Peninsula, I think in Ukraine too, it's some combination of Russia and someone else that appear to be pushing the key axis of diplomacy. Like the Russians and the Chinese have offered, I think, you know, a legitimate plan in the Korean Peninsula. As you all were saying, some combination of the Europeans and the Russians could maybe do something on Ukraine. And certainly in Syria, the Russians have seemed to have assembled the most credible diplomatic discussion about how to end the thing so far. And it just seems like that's also a subtext of this meeting.
You go ahead, Mark. I'll go second. You go first.
Yeah, I think there's a whole host of issues. I mean, we also can't forget missile defense and the U.S. now threatening to pull out of the intermediate range nuclear forces treaty. You know, Korea, Syria, Ukraine. There is a whole the buildup of NATO troops on Russia's borders and the military games back and forth on either side that are saber rattling and escalating tensions. The U.S. doing the same thing against China in the South China Sea, which is potentially even more dangerous, and we're looking at war games involving some 50,000 troops about to occur in the Black Sea in the next month. These are, I mean, we have never seen a state of relations between the U.S. and Russia this tense since the Cuban Missile Crisis, and that, you know, that's where Trump and Putin are sitting down. And I think the Trump administration does not have a clear foreign policy. They didn't have one coming in, and many of the new members of the cabinet, once Flynn was removed, McMaster's came in as NSA, Mattis, they are at war with the president, with Kushner, with Bannon, and others about what actual U.S. policy in Syria, which Trump seemed originally to dissent from, certainly what Obama was doing, from regime change and nation building in general. I think this administration is at war with itself, at war with, or at least at war with the deep state. And Russia is taking good advantage of that. That in many ways, U.S. indecision on
Syria and Ukraine, hesitation, allowing Russia to fulfill their desires, especially in Ukraine, is actually, that's good enough. That's what Russia, maybe the best they can hope
Mark,
for.
Let me jump in here. Let me jump in here and agree with you with some a little bit more finesse and detail. Mark's absolutely right. Let's look at the major crises that have been mentioned, or so-called crises. North Korea. Russia and China put together a diplomatic initiative, and I stress the word diplomatic. Let's take a look at Syria. Russia has repeatedly put together ceasefires, plans to that would avoid conflict in the air with the coalition in Russia and other Syria's allies. Look at Ukraine. We have the Minsk roadmap. They're all there. These are all diplomatic initiatives. Mark's absolutely right. We shouldn't be focusing in on Trump. We should be focusing on how the U.S. does or does not have a foreign policy, how a foreign policy works or doesn't work. And we can go other examples as well. And what is with this administration glaringly, and I think it's understaffed, is that the word diplomacy is dropped out of the lexicon almost completely. Mm. It's always, you know, everything on the table. Oh, this is very worrying. This is bad. I mean, this is foreign policy through Twitter. This is not coherent. And this is what, if you look at G20, under the is that you have a lot of these countries looking for different paths forward because, you know what, confidence in the United States is not high. And let's be frank, confidence in this president isn't very high. So I used the word multipolar in the beginning of our program here. This, what we've seen with the optics and all this, this is only going to accelerate this process.
Mm-hmm. No, I think that's a very well taken point there, and it'll be interesting to see how it all plays out. I know one of the things that is allegedly been announced out of this meeting is that there may be a U.S.-Russia joint ceasefire plan sort of monitored by them in Syria. So it'll be interesting to see how it plays out. You know, I want to swing back around, Mark, to a point that that both of you guys have been making, so I want both your thoughts on this. But that is this sort of internal war inside the U.S. I mean, I'm curious what you think is motivating the different factors, the deep state, whoever it may be, who seems to oppose to Trump, certainly the media as well, around this sort of Russia being the number one enemy of the United States, which just seems it's just hard for me to understand. I mean, it seems like it definitely can't be about what they say it's about. I mean, I live in Washington, D.C. The influence of foreign countries on U.S. politics, Saudi Arabia, Israel, even Norway, is significant, huge. So it's obviously not about that, but your thoughts.
This is it's really amazing that this is coming out of the U.S. I mean, Russia has long been accusing the U.S. of meddling in their foreign affairs. I mean, you can go back and look at Time magazine's covers from the 1990s celebrating that they got Boris Yeltsin elected, taking actual credit for it in what is widely acknowledged to be a rigged election, that his communist challenger, Zhuganov, probably should have won that election. And we've got researchers at Carnegie Mellon saying that the U.S. has interfered in foreign countries in their elections and politics 80 times between World War II and 2000, not even counting the last 17 years and not counting regime changes and invasions, coups. So, I mean, this is really pretty big projectionism on the U.S.'s part. This is an elite that is so used to interfering in other countries' affairs that they have been jumping at the opportunity to blame that their establishment lost. And the establishment lost. I mean, the Republican establishment lost in the primaries. The Democratic establishment lost in the general election. Trump does not represent the political establishment of the U.S. He is being co-opted every which way by them now, of course, but he does not represent them. And the biggest threat that he presented to them, other than disavowing regime change and nation building, at least rhetorically during the campaign, is his repeated insistence on repairing relations with Russia. And that's something that the deep state and the blob can simply not allow. They are ideologically, you could say genetically, predisposed towards painting Russia as an enemy. That's how they build up their own self-image. It really tells us more about their own psychology, the Manichaean nature that they need a bad guy to counterpose. And I see that everything that has been done so far on this Russiagate scandal, which I think is completely blown out of all proportion, you know, considering the quite normal U.S. and Russia hacking of each other, this is blown out of all proportion in a specific intent to either bring down or at least limit Trump's foreign policy, specifically preventing him from forging any type of detente with Russia.
Peter Lavelle, 2 minutes left. Your thoughts on the same issue?
Well, no, Mark is absolutely right, and I think we can simplify it very clearly for our listeners here, is the deep state is against peace. They're against peace. You can go to the flashpoints that we've brought up can be resolved. But you know what? It would be the perception of American prestige would take a hit. And that's something these people cannot accept. They can't. For example, the conflict in Syria could have, there were a number of points where it could have been resolved. But no, it would have meant concessions. And going echoing what Mark had to say is that the Russians would have to be involved. And you know what? They would get credit. That is unacceptable. That is unacceptable. That Russia can get credit for doing something positive in the world, and this is the dangerous times that we live in. When you have a fighting terrorism, Russia has been a victim of terrorism that has been the Wahhabi type ideology has been the origins of it. Russia has repeatedly been a victim of it, but no, we don't see the United States, Russia, and Europe working collectively in dealing with it. In fact, I would just say, you go much further, where you would never say this in, or allowed to be say this in mainstream media in the United States, is that, you know, the U.S. just has some pretty nasty allies, particularly in the Gulf. And, of course, it's already been mentioned here, it's always the 900-pound gorilla in the room, is that Israel's influence on the deep state, the foreign policy swamp that, unfortunately, Donald Trump is wading into. And I agree with Mark. I mean, he doesn't tolerate them. They tolerate him.
Absolutely. Well, we're going to have to leave it there, I think, here today with this segment. But we're going to take another break and come back with more here on By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. Big thanks to Peter Lavelle and Mark Svoboda for joining us. I'm your host, Eugene Perrier. Stay with us.
By Any Means Necessary.
Welcome back to By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Perrier, and as always, we're your guide to connecting the political, social, and economic movements shaping the world around us. Well, there are all sorts of things going on with people Donald Trump appointed, from Betsy DeVos to Neil Gorsuch to Steve Mnuchin, and all of the relevant information from all of those institutions and their actions coming up here. And we are happy to be joined by David Dayan for this conversation. He's the author of Chain of Title, How Three Ordinary Americans Uncovered Wall Street's Great Foreclosure Fraud, and a contributing writer at Salon and The Intercept, among other places. David, thank you so much for joining the show.
Oh, thank you.
So I wanted to start here with Betsy DeVos and these new lawsuits against her with the for-profit schools. I guess a lot of people had felt she would be very heavily in favor of for-profit education and would try to find some way to favor them. Now she's being sued over at least one thing, the borrower defense rule. So I wanted to just get into this, but I wanted to get some sense from you of what are some of these rules, the borrower defense rule. I think there's another one that she's also dealt with. What are they and what do they do?
Yeah, there are two key protections for students, rules that were put in near the end of the Obama administration that Betsy DeVos sought to delay. And one is called the borrower defense rule, and one is called the gainful employment rule. And I guess I'll start with the gainful employment rule. So what this was intended to do is look at all college-level programs across the country and try to assess whether they were actually providing what is known as gainful employment. And they did this by showing the level of debt that students had relative to their ability to pay it off. So the idea being that if they had a high number of defaults or something like that, that they wouldn't be able to pay that means that they weren't achieving the employment that they were sort of promised, particularly in these career technical and trade schools, which a large segment of those are for-profit colleges. So the idea was to look at these for-profits critically and show, are they keeping their promises to their students? Are they, when they say, you know, join up with us and you will actually be able to get an education you can use to get a job, is that actually working? So that was the one rule. And then the borrower defense rule actually is the fail-safe for what happens if these for-profit colleges actually don't follow through on their promises. If there is fraud based on lying about career placement, making promises that are then not kept, things like that, there's a clause in all student loan contracts that say, you know, a borrower has a defense to repayment if they were defrauded by their school. And this clause hasn't been used very much, but in the past few years, when we've seen a lot of for-profit colleges go under, there has been a lot of borrowers that have tried to use this clause. And there needed to be rules to understand, well, how does the process work? And so the borrower defense rule sort of clarified this whole idea of what happens when your school essentially defrauds you and you don't want to have to pay your student loan. So both of these rules are really protections for students to make sure, and protections for taxpayers, quite frankly, to make sure that these schools aren't using the significant amount of federal dollars that they get from the student loan program to finance what amounts to a fraud.
You know, I'm curious if there's any justice here. I mean, the way that DeVos is portraying it in the Department of Education is, well, you know, this is a quote-unquote regulatory reset, and because of at least one lawsuit filed by a for-profit company and educational company in California, we have to look at this again because there's all these other issues. I mean, is there any sort of justice in that, or is this really just kicking the can down the road sort of deal?
Well, I think what we've seen is that this is really a lifeline for these for-profit schools. When the gainful employment rule was put in, it found that of the programs that were failing this gainful employment rule, 98% of them were from for-profit colleges. So everybody knows what this rule was looking at and attacking, and everybody knows who this rule was trying to help. It was trying to help students who had been defrauded. And, you know, we'll see what happens with this lawsuit. The lawsuit is rather technical. It's around, you know, whether DeVos was allowed to delay the borrower defense rule. And we'll see, you know, it's kind of a side issue almost. But what we know is that in freezing these impending rules, DeVos is certainly inserting herself into this process on behalf of the for-profit college industry.
Mm. Well, you know, speaking to another Donald Trump appointment here, one of the most watched people has been Neil Gorsuch, and obviously lots of discussion based on what happened there at the end of the Supreme Court term. But one case that I missed, and you had a piece about this in the American Prospect, where Gorsuch, I believe, wrote the opinion, is Henson v. Santander, which is a very related issue, debt collections issues here. Very interesting piece there. This is really flying under the radar, but a major decision for the, I hate to even frame it this way, but I guess the rights of debt collectors.
Well, I mean, the actual lawsuit really is based on this reading of the Fair Debt Collections Practices Act, which is really the main law federally that stops debt collectors from harassing people who owe them money or claim to owe them money anyway. And it stops them from making calls at all hours of the night. It stops them from threatening them with deceptive information. It's a pretty powerful law in terms of consumer protection. And this case is kind of interesting. So Citi Financial made a bunch of car loans And some of those debts went into default. People didn't pay the car loan. And they sold those debts to this bank, Santander, which subsequently tried to collect. And according to the plaintiffs in the case, they were doing all of these things that were prohibited by the Fair Debt Collection Practices Act, harassing them at all hours of the night, making threats, things like that, intimidating the debtors, what have you. And Santander said, well, we bought these debts outright. We weren't trying to collect them on somebody else's behalf. So we're exempt from the Fair Debt Collectors Practices Act, because the definition of a debt collector in that law is someone collecting on behalf of somebody else.
Mm.
And the court unanimously, it wasn't just Gorsuch, but unanimously said, yeah, that's right. Now, they only looked at one definition under the actual text of who is a debt collector. But under that one definition, they found, yeah, that you have to be, you know, someone collecting a debt that is owed to somebody else. This predates, by the way, the Fair Debt Collection Practices Act was written in 1977, and ever since then, there's been this large debt buying industry where debt is just bought and sold on the open market. And, you know, there are third-party debt collectors on behalf of somebody else, which was big in, you know, at that time, is not necessarily the main way that debt collectors work today. So you can see sort of a roadmap to undermine this very important protection for people who are harassed by debt collectors simply by saying that the owner is the one doing the debt collection rather than somebody as a third party. So it's a technical rule, but by kind of coming in on the side of the debt collection industry, there's now been created this real roadmap to exempt practically everyone who collects debts from this law that is supposed to protect people from debt collectors.
Mm. Wow. I mean, that's when you put it together to some of these for-profit schools, when you get the education debt too, I mean, those people are unbelievable the way they come after you. I mean, it really just sort of seems like this is very much in line with a lot of sort of maybe what Trump sort of put out there for people coming in, that he really wanted to quote unquote reduce the regulatory burden and sort of shift more power back to the corporations.
Right. I mean, when you're talking about for-profit colleges, I mean, Trump owned one, right?
Mm-hmm.
He ran a thing called Trump University that was a kind of a fake college that tried to bilk people, paid a $25 million fine for, you know, deceptive practices with regard to that. So the idea that he would then, through his appointments, allow and enable those kinds of industries to flourish is not really surprising. And it's pretty disturbing on the case. I mean, obviously the judiciary is separate from Trump and the executive branch. Gorsuch, this was the very first opinion that he wrote, and he is a Trump appointee. It was a unanimous decision, and the real problem is that the court it really bends over backwards when the interests are corporate. And when the interests are consumers or individuals, not so much. So I think that's the real problem here. And what this case really illuminates is that there are all kinds of sort of loopholes that get driven into these laws that allow debt collectors, who are clearly their primary purpose is collecting debts, to hide that definition and therefore, you know, escape a statute that is supposed to be, you know, about debt collectors. And the individuals who are going to pay the price for that aren't really considered in that ruling. And so that's the problem for me. This kind of shows how the corporate court moves on regardless of the balance of power on it.
Wow. Well, turning to one more Trump appointee, I guess approved by the Senate here, Steve Mnuchin. Last time I had you on the show, we were talking a little bit about some of his record and what that may portend for his tenure at the Treasury Department. I feel like I just haven't heard a lot about what is going on with him and what he's pursuing in Treasury, which I thought to myself this morning actually really worries me, given the power of that office. So I'm curious on how you're evaluating so far the moves he's been making there as Treasury Secretary.
Sure. So there was finally this very large report that came out from the Treasury Department. This came out in the middle of June, I'd say, and Trump asked his Treasury Secretary to put together, you know, sort of a review of all financial regulations and report back as to whether they meet with his principles. And the Treasury Department said, well, we can't do them all. We can do them one at a time, or we can do them piecemeal. And they came out with the first report. And the first report is really a wish list for the industry. And more dangerously, it's not necessarily things that have to be passed by Congress. This Treasury report had the assistance of 240 different banking industry groups, and it at times cited or lifted directly from you know, briefing papers put together by bank lobbyists, and it identifies all these ways that regulators could go around Congress and undermine our financial regulatory laws without having to involve the legislative branch at all. So, you know, there was a lot of kind of fear around the time that the House of Representatives passed this thing called the Choice Act, which would have completely overhauled Dodd-Frank and ripped out a lot of those rules. But I would say that this is the bigger danger to financial regulation, is this effort that the Treasury Department published. You know, we know the roadmap, and because it doesn't have to go through Congress at all, there are many ways that they can simply go ahead and undermine various rules, from everything from the stress tests that come out every year that take a look at whether a bank can survive a downturn in the economy, or things like the Volcker Rule, which are supposed to ban institutions that take deposits from making risky trades with depositor money. There are all sorts of little tweaks in the law that don't get a lot of attention, but can be done, you know, by just a reinterpretation of regulations. Now, it's going to take some time to do that reinterpretation, but in the meantime, you can sort of repeal laws by neglect just by not enforcing them. And so the combination of not enforcing the laws very much and then working to undermine them through regulatory changes means that you can really transform the financial regulatory system without ever having to change a word of the law.
Well, I guess I was right to be a little concerned about not having
you were.
Heard enough. You know, speaking of regulation, one other issue that has really been on my mind is this Amazon Whole Foods purchase thing. And I guess I wasn't super surprised to see that it happened, but I thought to myself, it just seems like the whole issue of monopoly power has totally dropped off the map in America, but corporations in every field are becoming more and more concentrated. Do we need to look more closely at this issue?
Yeah, we absolutely should be concerned, and you're right to pinpoint it, and you're particularly right to pinpoint the rise of what I would call platform monopolies, these large internet firms, Google, Facebook, Amazon, that have a platform that is very compelling and something that people come to every day. And then through sort of the effect of, well, everybody's on Facebook, so I have to be on Facebook, or everybody shops at Amazon, so I have to shop at Amazon, they gain this monopoly power. Whole Foods, this purchase from Amazon, is a way to sort of move from the online to the offline space. But it also is sort of an increase of the things that Amazon is already doing. This gives them 450 storefronts in high-income zip codes to do all of the things that they're already engaged in, whether it's collecting more data so that they know what products people want to buy, and then they can make knockoffs of them and lower the price to undercut these other sellers, or it's using them as centers where people can pick up their packages and it gets them in the store. It's ways to leverage their Prime memberships so that they can give maybe cheaper, maybe it's not whole paycheck, but half paycheck if you have a Prime membership. You know, there are all sorts of ways that Amazon is becoming sort of America's company store. The last stat that I heard is 50% of all online purchases begin at Amazon. That is an enormous number, and especially when you consider that the Amazon marketplace is where all these other sellers are coming to deliver their goods, and then Amazon picks up the data of what is doing well and what isn't, and then they're also a competitor by creating their own line of goods to those same sellers. That is really, really dangerous. And what happens with this kind of concentration is it leads to a sapping of the sort of vitality of the economy, a sapping of entrepreneurship, a sapping of small business increases and growth. And it concentrates both economic and political power in very few hands. And that is dangerous for a democracy.
Mm-hmm, absolutely. Well, David, thank you so much for joining the show. People should go to daviddan.tumblr.com. You can keep up with all his different pieces on a lot of this stuff. Pick up his book, Chain of Title. And that is where we are going to have to leave it today here on By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Perrier. See you next time.
By any means necessary.